From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Today on The Lines Between Us, our series about inequality in our region, the toll of unemployment, not just on individuals without jobs, but also on their communities. First, we'll hear the voices of unemployed people in the Baltimore region. Then we'll ask a mental health professional at Johns Hopkins Bayview about the effect of unemployment and persistent poverty on the lives of those who face it every day. Then, The Lines Between Us continues as we examine one of the few paths to the middle class from traditionally disadvantaged neighborhoods, serving in the military. Tom Hall talks to two servicemen about how military service has improved economic and educational prospects for some Baltimore residents. Plus a Baltimore story from Gilbert Sandler. Headlines first.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You've tuned in to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's WYPR.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our weekly series about inequality in our region. For the past few weeks, we've been talking about employment in Baltimore. We've asked how employers can become more inclusive in their workforce. We've examined how minority social networks affect their employment opportunities. We've asked where are the jobs in Baltimore and how are they being connected to those who need them. Today we want to learn more about what happens to people, their families, and their communities when they're out of work for a long time. We'll start by hearing a few of the many stories from Baltimore residents who are unemployed or underemployed and the toll that financial instability takes on them. Assistant producer Jamila Kay brings us this report.
Doreen is 41. She works part-time as a seasonal janitor, taking care of the facilities played in by the Baltimore Ravens and the Baltimore Orioles. But home games won't be played at M&T Bank Stadium until next season, and baseball doesn't start until April, so Doreen is out of work. If that wasn't enough, when I spoke to her this week, another challenge confronted her and her family.
We've been evicted. So we're moving our stuff. So I'm in the car now with the load.
Doreen and her husband are moving to a friend's place in West Baltimore, but they can only stay until April.
We don't know what we're going to do after that, but I'm trying to find a full-time job.
The other members of Doreen's family, including her husband and 20-year-old daughter, are also looking for stable employment.
She works a part-time seasonal, and she has another part-time job. My baby's awesome.
Doreen is on unemployment insurance, but she says it barely covers the cost of her cell phone bill and car insurance. The stress of a limited income takes its toll, but she says she has several ways of coping, including playing video games with her daughter. When the pressure becomes too much, Doreen says she seeks professional help.
I have a psychiatrist that I visit and a therapist because when my brain goes on the fret, it seems like there's like no hope. I kind of shut down. I don't have, any motivation to do anything. But I know I have to do something. But for some reason, it doesn't come out that way. I just want to leave. I want to leave Earth. But that's one reason why I take the antidepressant, because all kinds of thoughts come in my mind sometimes, you know. I have a child to live for, so I stick around.
Many can identify with the stress that accompanies financial issues, but when that stress produces other psychological problems, such as anxiety and depression, it makes moving on to the next phase of employment all the more difficult.
I'll be here earlier next week.
Every Tuesday afternoon, a group gathers in the lobby of the First Christian Church in North Roland Park for its Job Hunters support group. Forming a circle around the fireplace, each person takes turns updating the group on their employment prospects, their families, and their challenges. The six job hunters at this meeting come from diverse backgrounds, and their length of unemployment and underemployment varies.
It's been a year. I was doing some financial work, some editing work, some administrative work, so it's multifaceted.
I've been unemployed for about 1 month now. I was in finance. I was the CFO of a major manufacturer in Pennsylvania for 15 years, a $120 million company.
In 2011, I got a certificate in environmental restoration through the Workforce Investment Act.
I work part-time for a National Historic Site as the shop manager. But I also worked at a big insurance company, so I have a variety of Microsoft suite of application skills and things of that nature. I've been underemployed. 5 years.
The group started in November of 2011, when its leader, Nancy, moved to North Carolina to Baltimore to be near her aging parents. She couldn't find a job in her field of over 25 years, working with children and parents as a play therapist, counselor, and educator. She says she was looking for a support group for those lacking stable employment, and when one couldn't be found, she started one at the church. One of the top challenges that Nancy says participants struggle with is dealing with depression.
One of the things we talk a lot about in here are the messages that we give ourselves, because we can make choices all the time and do make choices all the time about what we tell ourselves. So even if we think, I think that's a good example, I'm too old, nobody's going to hire me, you know. Well, then we can challenge that. It's like, that might be true for some people. Some people might would rather hire somebody younger, but that can't be true all the time. It's just not. You know, we can spiral down or we can come back up again. And that's one of those ongoing things. Doesn't seem to be like a one-time solution to depression.
For some of the people at this group, the group itself becomes a way to cope.
There are two issues to deal with, and that is the finding the job and to deal with the psychological part. And I find that this is absolutely fantastic because this helps you deal with the depression and the ups and downs. I think the ups and downs are the biggest problem that I struggle with because I am an older father. I have two preschool children. Having to deal with that responsibility for things outside of my control, that I really struggle with.
Having some structure to the day and staying busy. Otherwise, that black dog of depression can start trying to come in the door.
It's a lot. It really is a lot to deal with. And it's not so much that you may not want to work, but you may not know how to go about looking for work, or you may just have given up.
For the majority of people in the group, they say they want to find work in their field, if possible. But some say they are looking to see what new opportunities may become available. That includes Doreen, who we heard from first. Beyond securing a full-time job, she said she wants to fulfill a dream she's had for a long time, but she still wants a sense of security.
My ultimate dream is to start my own business. It's a clothing business that I dreamt up when my daughter was a baby. I'm really not looking for riches. I'm looking to live comfortably without having to struggle and to worry about money, worry about bills, worry about where I'm going to stay, where I'm going to spend the rest of my life. I want life insurance.
Practical desires. But right now, for the more than 90,000 people who are unemployed in Baltimore, just out of reach.
Assistant producer Jamila Kay.
This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We just heard the personal stories of a few of the many unemployed and underemployed in Baltimore. We want to understand better the psychological toll on children and families living in poverty, especially persistent poverty, and its larger effect on the community. Joining us from his office at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center is Dr. Stephen Shapiro. He's clinical supervisor of Child Mobile Treatment Services at Bayview. Dr. Shapiro is also the co-coordinator of Psychologists for Social Responsibility's Poverty and Inequality Project. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us about your work with mobile treatment services. What is the background of most of the children and families you work with?
So the children and families have to live below the poverty line. It's actually a little bit above the poverty line here in Maryland to be available to come to mobile treatment. And mobile treatment services are community-based mental health services for children and their families who are unable to succeed, however that's defined, in other treatment modalities, or they're being stepped down from hospitals. They come with a wide range of diagnoses. It can include depression and anxiety, which most people typically know about, but also a panoply of behavioral disorders, and those would include acting out, aggression, disruptive behavior in schools. So the kids have lots of behavioral issues as well as mental health issues.
And you also work with Psychologists for Social Responsibility. What is that?
Right. That's an organization. It's a national and international organization. It's a relatively small group, a little under 1,000 psychologists and allied professionals, not just mental health, who are really passionate about injustices that are perceived in the world, and we do what we can to try and right some of those injustices, and that's through any number of activist projects.
We've been talking a lot about unemployment in our series. Explain in your work the difference between long-term unemployment or underemployment and poverty. How is the experience different?
Long-term unemployment is just one of the many elements of living without income. Poverty, of course, is the longer term that many people experience. In the city of Baltimore, of course, that's a huge problem.
Well, is what you're describing what's called persistent poverty, or is that something beyond that?
So, well, there are different definitions, but the more persistent poverty is, the longer you live without income, the greater the deficits in functioning, and that's been shown time and again. And people who are homeless have even more difficulty because they don't have a place, a structure around them in which to live, which actually helps with mental health, even though sometimes the structures are not so pleasant. Some of the children and families we work with live in really deplorable conditions. So sometimes the conditions themselves can create psychological problems. So what we're talking about here is that people who live in poverty or without income that extends over a longer period of time actually will often have deeper mental health and behavioral problems. That's not universal. Some people will have supports in the community. They'll have other family members with whom they can live. They'll have a church to go to where they can get succor and attention and resources. So there are resiliency factors.
And is there a way to address the mental health problems without more money? I mean, if
well, that, so that's a great question. And the simple answer is yes. So mental health treatment in and of itself is not a particularly efficacious way to deal with long-term unemployment and poverty. And I'm not by any means advocating it. It's really a structural issue, requires structural solutions. It does seem that most of our communities, and I would venture to say Baltimore is part of that, are not well equipped to deal with issues of long-term unemployment, with poverty, with inequality, and by and large don't deal with it. And so mental health is a Band-Aid approach as far as I'm concerned. So we can treat some of the symptoms, and that's what we get. We get a child who's acting out in school, for instance, is aggressive or is disruptive and disrupting the other kids in the classroom. And that's not atypical for many of the Baltimore City schools, and I don't mean to disparage them because I know they're really struggling to do good work. But we have lots of kids in our community here in the city and also in the county in the larger area who suffer with family members who are unemployed or have been in poverty for many years for a long period of time. And we can go in and we can treat the symptoms we see. We can treat that disruptive behavior, that aggressive behavior, sometimes with positive outcomes. But that doesn't change the underlying conditions that engender the problem. And ultimately, these kids go back to their families and go back to the same homes and the same neighborhoods and the same communities where the problems persist. And so it really is applying Band-Aids to problems that are much larger than the individual. But it also prevents us from seeing the larger picture, which is that these kids and these families are impoverished in part because of, in large part because of the structures of our society are not set up to prevent them from being poor or from being unemployed. It's probably important to just frame this a little bit because we haven't done so yet. So in the city of Baltimore, Baltimore has a population of about 600,000, roughly 25% live in poverty. And another 25% live just above poverty. So you're talking about half of the city of Baltimore lives at or just above or just below the poverty level, essentially. And so all of the research shows that all of the people who live even just a little bit above poverty experience similar stressors that lead to similar behavioral and mental health outcomes, negative outcomes. And the worst statistic is probably this one, that in the city of Baltimore, a little over 37% of the children develop in poverty. So you're talking about an enormous problem just here in our own city. For comparative purposes, the whole state of Maryland only has about a 10% poverty rate and a child poverty rate of 13%.
That's Dr. Steve Shapiro, clinical supervisor of Child Mobile Treatment Services at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center here on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Dr. Shapiro is also co-coordinator of Psychologists for Social Responsibilities, Poverty and Inequality Project. Let me delve a little bit into what you were describing, a huge proportion of children developing in poverty. So what happens when kids grow up in that kind of poverty, persistent poverty?
You can easily drive through East, West, or parts of South Baltimore and see streets that have many houses boarded or bricked up, litter everywhere, kids, usually young people on the corner selling drugs, violence. This is the atmosphere in which these kids grow up, and the homes themselves are often in pretty bad shape. Often single mothers, but not just single mothers, trying to maintain, usually with several kids, on very little money. We have the sense that these kids and their parents actually bring in all kinds of federal and state dollars. And in fact, many of our children and families live on $600 or $700 a month.
Most of the Baltimore neighborhoods that you're describing, the residents are predominantly black or
yes,
Latino.
That's correct. It's good to think about the racial equation. So in the United States, 50% of people living below the poverty line are actually white, and 29% are African American. That's because there are more whites than African Americans. So in terms of sheer numbers, but their racial disparities are huge. So 25% of African Americans live below the poverty line in the United States, whereas only 8% of whites do. So yes, it's largely black, but in fact, poverty runs across racial lines and affects everybody equally. It doesn't matter your race. Sadly, because of the racial disparity and the other problems with racial inequity, it's like a double-layered problem.
And the impact you're describing, you're talking about individuals, but you're also talking about an impact on the community, on the neighborhood?
Communities that have greater inequality, that means greater disparity between the rich and the poor. So there's poverty, which is living below a certain threshold, an income threshold, and then there's inequality, which is that disparity between the rich and the poor. And those communities that have greater inequality have all kinds of social indicators. We're talking about things as wide-ranging as criminal behavior and educational success and single pregnancy and obesity is one of the indicators, actually. So a great book called The Spirit Level came out several years ago by Wilkinson and Pickett and definitively shows, although some people have disputed some of the data, there's some newer data that are even better, and that indicate that the greater the inequality, the greater the problems for everybody in that community, not just for the people living at the bottom. I'm more focused myself on the social and cultural issues and the economic issues of poverty and what are we going to do about deterring poverty so that our children grow up to be adults who are, according to current societal definitions at least, are more functional in a way that makes our community better for everybody.
There is a lot of public debate, though, about how to create more jobs and get fewer, so there'll be fewer people unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of discussion about who has the skills for jobs and how to organize jobs so that even people with minimal skills might have a crack at getting a job. That's mm-hmm. not the debate you want to hear.
I hate to throw out statistics because it does warp the mind a bit, but I am going to throw out a few that are federal statistics. So in the United States, more than 70% of poor children, impoverished children, were members of working families in 2010. And then 76% of single mothers who had households in the United States, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, were working. So I don't think it's just a matter of creating more jobs, although we certainly need more jobs. These are mostly single women, but not entirely, who are working low-wage jobs. And this is a problem around the world. So many interventions in Baltimore City and county and in the state and in the country apply to adults. So you're trying to teach adults skills when they're in their teens, late teens or 20s or 30s, and that would be the job training and the social skills training. Some of these adults have difficulty socially because of the way they developed. And that, again, speaks to where do we do our interventions? What kinds of things can we do as a society? Do we just try and create some more jobs? Well, that's great. I think that's an important thing we need to do. We need to create more jobs. But what happens if you have tens of millions of people who don't have the skill set because of the way they develop by the age of 5 to be able to meet the needs of those jobs? And again, it's not because there's something wrong with them. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with them. They're like you and me. They grew up in deprivation, and that deprivation has a huge, huge effect on psychological and behavioral functioning. It would affect everybody that way, and it does.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Steve Shapiro is Clinical Supervisor of Child Mobile Treatment Services at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. More information and more of this interview on our website, wypr.org. Click on Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. I want to let you know about a milestone this weekend in East Baltimore, St. Francis Xavier Church, which describes itself as the oldest African-American Catholic faith community, is celebrating its 150th anniversary, starting with Mass at 10 a.m. Sunday. Then the mayor will unveil a new sign labeling that stretch of Caroline Street at Oliver, St. Francis Xavier Way. You are listening to The Lines Between Us on Marilyn Morning. Later, the impact of the military on employment prospects. Stay tuned to 88.1.
You're listening to the Marilyn Morning Podcast. I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website for more podcast, audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Marilyn Morning. That's wypr.org. Click on the Marilyn Morning link.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. In July of this year, the military will mark 40 years as an all-volunteer force. When the draft ended in 1973, some experts worried that the military would have a difficult time recruiting enough people to sustain adequate troop levels. By and large, that has not been the case. Especially in a recession for many young people, military service is one of the most attractive employment options in a climate in which options are often limited. We're going to examine some of the reasons for that. Joining me now in the studio is Staff Sergeant Adam Harvey, an Army recruiter at the Mondawmin Mall and Towson recruiting stations in the Baltimore area, and K.T. Tyler, a former Marine who is the membership chair for the Baltimore chapter of the National Association of Black Veterans. Gentlemen, thank you for your service, and thank you for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
So, Mr. Tyler, let me start with you. Why did you join the Marines? You were 19 years old. Take us back to that time in your life.
Well, I was given an option at the age of 18, whether to continue going to college or continue going to the military. And I chose college first, of course, because it was the easy way. And after 1 year, I'm like, whoa, this is not for me. So I then had another choice, which was the military. That's the only choice. And I said, well, if I'm going to go into a branch, what is the best branch to go into? What is the toughest? And I was told that it was the Marine Corps. So that's what I did. I joined the Marine Corps. And I had a hard time transitioning from Brooklyn, New York, into while I'm in boot camp, you know, someone telling me what to do, when to do it, how to do it in my face. I had a real tough time in the beginning. Plus, having a girlfriend back at home that I was missing and she wasn't writing letters. I was writing 15 million letters and she's not responding. So I'm like, uh-oh, Jody's got her.
Yeah.
So it was kind of difficult for me. But then I just kind of let that go and transitioned just to focus on my boot camp and what they was telling me. And I became very a stellar Marine at that time, and if they could promote, they only could promote two if they could promote a third, I would have been the one able to promote it. So
I'm interested why you say that it was your only other choice. Why is that?
Because my parents told me I can either go to college or go to the military. That's it.
Okay. So they made the choice.
They made the
it.
Choice. Uh-huh. Exactly. Uh-huh. So that's the only choices I had. So, and I think it was a very, very good choice for me. At the time, I was, you know, hanging, not getting in trouble, but I was just hanging out a lot, you know, partying like every teenage kid does.
Sure.
But I was working, but it just wasn't what they wanted for my life. So, and at the time, I didn't know what I wanted. So they kind of helped me and steered me in a direction. And the military was a good direction for me at that time.
Mm-hmm. Sergeant Harvey, of course, you spend your days recruiting new folks to the military. But how about your own personal story? Why did you join?
Both my parents were in the military. They met while they were actually stationed over in Germany. And also, my stepfather was in the military also. I was looking for money for school. I grew up in a single mom. My brother's father passed away before he was born. So, you know, my mom was kind of on her own, bringing up two kids, really didn't have enough money for school. So I looked to the Army Reserves to help pay for college.
And that's what's happened to you? Did you end up getting your college degree?
I'm still working on finishing up. Hopefully next couple years here, I will finish up, have my law degree, and then kind of go on from there, law, politics, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. About 1% of the American population have been fighting our two most recent wars, and many folks bemoan the fact that, you know, this very dangerous work of being in the military is being done by young people who often come from disadvantaged backgrounds, because this is, for many of them, sort of a really good and in some cases, you know, singular option. Is that your experience as a recruiter? Is that the kind of kids that are coming to you now? Are these the folks from lower socioeconomic things? And what's your feeling about the fact that those kinds of kids are now starting to populate and have been for a while populating the troop force?
Well, I think over history, it's always been like that. Most of your military has been the, lower economic portion of your population. I mean, however, we do have kids to graduate from Johns Hopkins come down and sign up also. You know, so we do get a mix, but yes, it is a majority of the lower to lower middle class, you know. But at the same time, it's something that will help them and their family make that step up to the middle, upper middle. You know what I mean? Whatever it takes to get that college degree to, you know, to get your foot in the door.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Tyler, you served for how long in the Marines?
I did 7 years total. I did 4 years active and 4 years inactive. I mean, 3 years inactive.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that, in fact, it prepared you? I mean, the military advertises a career in the military as being a great way to prepare you for life on the outside, prepare you for a career in the workforce. Has that been the case with you?
I would say yes. It did a really remarkable job as far as discipline. I was raised by my grandmother and my mother initially until my mother got married. So Me having the male support really wasn't there too much unless one of my uncles came around. My father was like a distant father. But the military did groom me into being well-disciplined and well-rounded young man. And actually, when I got out of the military, I was fortunate enough to go back and coach at my high school as a head JV coach. But my philosophy wasn't just on football. I wanted them to get more out of just playing a game, but knowing that when I say show up on time for practice, it's not just for showing on time for practice, showing on time for anything in life, meaning when you go into a job interview, you need to show up on time and have the things that you needed.
On 88.1, it's The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Staff Sergeant Adam Harvey is an Army recruiter at the Mondawmin Mall and Towson recruiting stations, and K.T. Tyler served in the Marines. He's also the membership chair for the Baltimore chapter of the National Association of Black Veterans. So, Sergeant Harvey, who are you looking for when folks come in the door to recruit for the Army these days?
Some of the qualifications, I mean, anyone between the ages of 17 and 34. You had to pass height and weight. The body fat percentage for someone, say, 17 to 21 is about 24%. Older you get, a little bit more is allowed. You know, you start putting on a couple extra pounds.
So you got to be in shape.
Yeah, you got to be in shape. Medical conditions, you can have asthma, heart murmurs, epilepsy, you know, any major medical, you know, no ADD medication, can't currently be on anything like that, you know. Law violations, no possession charges, no theft over 500, no kind of spousal abuse, anything in the home, you know, or, assault.
You have to have a high school diploma?
Well, yes. Usually high school diploma, every once in a while, they will open up the GED category. Mm-hmm. And as long as you score 50 or above on the ASVAB test, then
which is sort of the entrance exam.
Exactly. And you have to get at least a minimum of 31 on the entrance exam test. Mm-hmm. That's probably the hardest piece right there in this area is passing the ASVAB test. You know?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, the Defense Department has announced that they're looking towards a drawdown of about 27,000 enlisted troops beginning in 2015. Since 2010, the number of recruits has steadily diminished. Mr. Tyler, even during this diminishment of people enlisting, minority enlistment has actually risen a little bit, or stayed steady, or risen a little bit. You work with the Black Veterans Association. Is this a good thing that minorities are continue to be very interested in military careers?
I would say yes, and the reason why I say yes is because it was an opportunity for me to get outside of my community and explore the world of being raised and born in Brooklyn, New York. And now resided in Baltimore, Maryland. And I can understand for the city of Baltimore, the young kids that they're looking for different things to do. And it takes them out of off the street. It takes them out of doing violent things. And it also gives them an opportunity to explore the country, to explore the world, you know, to travel.
Yeah, you travel a lot.
To travel and also to get the education that they may not be able to afford. Just like Stasson Harvey said that his mom wasn't able to afford him to go to college. Well, the military is the next best thing besides getting a government grant or besides getting some awarded an opportunity to go to school. The military is the next best thing to afford a person an opportunity, especially in the economic status that the country is in now.
Mm-hmm. So the discipline is a big dimension of this for you, the discipline and the teamwork and those kinds of skills. How about specific skills? Are there things that you learn to do? For example, you're now working for AIG Insurance. Were there specific things that you were trained to do in the military that you have a direct application in your current job?
The reason why I say yes is because when I set an appointment, I'm expected to be there. Mm-hmm. In the military, when you're expected to get up and do something, that is, it's everybody does it. You know, that's the way we're trained. We train as a unit, but we also train that we always arrive on time, 15 minutes before, you know, and that's, it's embedded throughout my whole career as being in the military. And that's what when I show up for work or show up for an appointment, I show up 15 minutes early just because that's how I was trained in the military. So that's mm-hmm. the discipline that I had, and I can kind of relate that to the military.
The vets who serve since 9/11, I have an unemployment rate nationally of about 10.8%, and that's, you know, a couple of points higher, almost 3 points higher than the national average. There have been some initiatives. The White House, Mrs. Obama and Dr. Biden have put together a program to connect military families and spouses with potential employers. Just a couple of days ago, Walmart announced that they're going to instantly hire vets within a year of their discharge from the military. There are those who say that that's kind of a PR stunt, and we'll leave that discussion for another day.
Yeah, right.
But why do you think that is, and what do you think, from your experience with the Black veterans, what is the answer to that dilemma that so many vets are coming back from combat and not finding employment?
That's the answer that everyone wants to know. I mean, I have no concrete answer for that, but I know for the National Search for Black Veterans, what we're doing is we're partnering with different organizations to support that effort to employ, you know, veterans that are unemployed. So we're really trying to tackle that effort, and we're doing it right now as we speak to help veterans, because if you serve the country or serve your country, there's no reason why you should come back and not be able to be employed as a civilian.
Yeah, I think almost everybody would agree with that for sure. And Staff Sergeant Harvey, are you finding people on the upper end of the age limit also thinking about enlisting in the military? The age that you're looking for is 17 to 34. You're getting a lot of the folks in the early 30s?
We accept people anywhere from 17 to 34. Our prime market is 17 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a few older people come in. I put someone in that was in their 40s, and right before they turned 42, back when we would accept them years ago when I first started recruiting. The problem with older people is, I say older, I'm talking late 20s, early 30s. If you have a wife and kids and such, you know, pulling them out of this area, taking them away from the family and stuff, mm-hmm. is a little bit harder to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot easier for a single man or woman to join the military because they don't have, you know, wife, children, husband, whatever, You know, it's easier to make that transition.
There was some discussion among military experts, and they worried about it when even 40 years ago when the draft ended, that the Army and all the military forces were going to have to offer more geographic stability. They weren't going to be able to move people around as much. What's the current thinking in the Army about that? I mean, if you join, do you have any influence at all in terms of where you're stationed?
A lot of it depends on your MOS, your military occupational specialty, or your job. Certain jobs are only in certain areas. Other ones are all over the place. You have a little bit of say-so as far as where you go. I mean, your first duty station, it's, you know, you're going to go where the Army needs you at the end of the day, but you can request to go to different places. Every single soldier has a different circumstance or different, their experience is different.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both again for your service and for your time and perspective this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Staff Sergeant Adam Harvey is an Army recruiter at the Mondawmin Mall and Towson recruiting stations here in Baltimore. KT Tyler served in the Marines. He's also membership chair for the Baltimore chapter of the National Association of Black Veterans. We've got more information on our website at WIPR.org. On Monday morning, Inauguration Day and MLK Day, we'll talk to some local folks about how they are celebrating. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick will tell us what she thinks of the new play at the new Everyman Theater. And I'll also talk to a scholar about visual imagery in the civil rights movement. That's all coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.